For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Welcome to the parsha called Shlach Lecha. Okay? And the main theme of our parsha is the sending of the spies to the land of Israel to spy it out. I guess that's why they're called spies, isn't it? Right, they're spying out the land of Israel to see what's strong, what's the weak areas, what does the land look like, what's the lay of the land, for the purpose of going in there and conquering Israel, right? This is the whole, right, like climax of our wandering the Midbar in the desert. It's not the climax of coming out of Egypt, let's make that clear. That was getting the Torah, okay? But the Torah can never be fulfilled in its shlemus, in its completeness, without the land of Israel. So this is, you know, the big event, Meraglim. Meraglim means spies. Interesting, the Hebrew word Meraglim, bear this in mind, is related to the word regel. Anybody know what regel means? Legs, feet, because that's what spies do. They travel on their feet, you know, they go around. Right? Keep that in mind, the feet being the lowest part of the body. Okay? So they go in, spy the land, and instead of coming back with a truthful report, they come back with a slanderous report, or Lashon Hara, on the land of Israel. Chofetz Chaim warns, a person has to be careful this very day about ever speaking derogatory about the land of Israel. And that's one of the reasons the juxtaposition of this parsha to last week's parsha of Miriam's Lashon Hara, right? The spies didn't learn that lesson and spoke Lashon Hara on the land of Israel. We're going to see, though, it's on their level. Okay, 10 of the 12 spies brought back a false report and discouraged the people. Right, just took the wind out of their sails. Two of them brought back a truthful report. They were righteous. They were, of course, Yehoshua and Caleb. Big, big tzaddikim. Okay, so we're going to try to discuss an insight again on the sin of the spies. As always, when we talk about sins of big people, I say big people because if you look at the listing of the princes of the tribes, the spies, right, of these tribes are listed in order of their tzitzkis, of their righteousness. And number five, you know, on your hit parade here, though he's number one in our hearts, but he's number five, is Yehoshua. That means four of these other spies were on a higher level than him. I'm trying to tell you, these were very big tzaddikim. So we have to analyze the sin on their level. What was it about? How do they come back with a false report? How could they do that? We're talking about great, great people. How could they, you know, slip up like that? Okay, so after this incident, we have the Torah portion talks about the mitzvah called challah. Which is challah. It's interesting. You know, it's very interesting. Challah really means take a portion. That's what challah means. You know, take a portion, right? So what do? When we, you know, bake bread, especially the ladies, right? That's a special mitzvah. One, three special mitzvahs for a lady. She takes the bread, she takes a portion, says a bracha, and she burns a piece of the challah. It's interesting that we call challah is not an appropriate name. It's lechem. It's bread. You know, lechem mishnah. You have two loaves of bread on Shabbos, right? This is so beautiful. But we call it challah. Why? Because what's beloved to us is the mitzvahs. Right? It's the mitzvah. So we call the name of the bread challah after the mitzvah that's associated with it. Yeah? It's beautiful. I remember being in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Zalman Brizel. At that time he was in his 90s. And I remember he's telling his wife, bring me a mezainis. In other words, a mezainis means something that's of the five grains, a cookie, cake. He didn't care what it was. He didn't say, bring me the chocolate cake. He wanted the bracha to say mezainis. So bring me a mezainis, like any mezainis will do, just so I can say the bracha. So that's what we have to learn from that. The main thing should be the mitzvah, you know, not the food. So here it's beautiful. We call the lechem mishnah, the two loaves of bread, by the name of the mitzvah, challah. Challah means a portion. We found something similar, though a little bit different, back about in Pesach, right? We talked about how the phrase in the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, Ani LaDodi VeDodi Li, I am to my beloved, and my beloved is to me, and we refer to Pesach as Pesach because we recount the miracle and the kindness that Hashem skipped over our houses during the Makas B'chayrus, the plague of the death of the firstborn. But in the Torah, the holiday is called Chag HaMatzos, the festival of matzahs, because that's God speaking. What's beloved in God's eyes? That His children are doing His mitzvahs. And as we all know, the mitzvah on Pesach is matzah, and matzah, and matzah. Right? So, you see this very often, that we call things after the mitzvah. Okay, so that's another thing in the Parsha. We have a certain korban that's brought, a sacrifice that's brought. If the Sanhedrin, the leaders of the nation, make a mistake, all the nation has to bring an offering. We'll have to discuss why, right? And then the Torah portion, I may be skipping some things, but the Torah portion ends with the famous third paragraph of the Shema, the Tzitzis Parsha, right? Make for yourself tzitzis. Okay, we'll have to try to discuss the significance of that in this Parsha. What's the connection? Okay? Those are some of the things in the portion. Any questions? Kind of answered this question in Pirkei Avos. And it's coming up in, I believe, in next week's Torah portion, that when Moshe Rabbeinu, as soon as he finds out that he is destined not to lead the children of Israel, you know, in Israel, he says, Hashem, Elokei, Ruach, I can remember, Ruach Kol Basar, some language like that, that you're the spirit of all flesh, the spirit of all man, you know the spirit of every man, appoint a leader over Israel that can relate to the spirit of every man. In other words, everybody has different personalities. And Yahushua, besides being the main disciple of Moshe Rabbeinu, as we mentioned, his portion of Man was equal to all of Israel, which means his insights into the Torah as the main disciple was equivalent to all Israel. He had the capacity to be able to deal with individual personalities. As we mentioned, Moshe Rabbeinu was afraid that Pinchas, who was so great, such a big tzaddik, would be the next leader of Israel, and that would be bad, because he's a zealot. And a zealot, even though they're righteous and great, they really can't relate to the everyday man, so to speak. Okay? So that's nice insight I'm giving you. But the real answer to your question is explained in the Gemara, why Yahushua was picked as the next leader. It's a verse in Proverbs. And it says, he who guards the fig tree, let him eat from it. Which means Yahushua was the man that stayed after the classes. He put the chairs away. He put the books away. It says Lo Yamush. He never moved from Moshe Rabbeinu. He is the arch example of a devoted, loyal disciple to his Rebbe. This is the prototype. Right? He clung to every word Moshe Rabbeinu had to say. He came early. He never left Moshe Rabbeinu's side. Even when Moshe Rabbeinu went to Mount Sinai to get the Torah, and no one else was allowed to go up, but Yahushua was allowed to go up higher than anybody else. He went like halfway up the mountain and stayed there. He didn't go down with the rest of the people. Right? He stayed there waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu. So that fact that he cleaved to his Rebbe, right? Moshe Rabbeinu, he got the most Torah that anybody could possibly did. He absorbed all the possible character traits, the humility and everything else Moshe Rabbeinu had to offer, right? And that devotion, I guess that's the key word here, devotion and humility of Yahushua, and he continually protests against being the next leader. Last week's Torah portion, he heard a prophecy that said, Moshe meis of Yahushua machnis. Moshe's going to die and Yahushua is going to take us into the land of Israel. And he told Moshe, Adoni, my master, shut him up. I don't want to hear that. And in this week's Torah portion, if you notice, his name is Hosea. It doesn't, his name is not Yehoshua, his original name, okay? Verse 8. Hosea ben Nun, and Rashi tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu gave him a bracha, gave him a blessing. May God save you from the council of the spies. And added a Yud, which is the letter of Hashem's name to his name, Yehoshua. It becomes known as Yehoshua. So the question is, why did he need a blessing? The other righteous one, Kalev, did not get a blessing from Moshe. Why did Yehoshua? Yehoshua was so humble, right, that, listen to this, there's many reasons, but one of the beautiful insights I saw is that Yehoshua's humility and his utter devotion to Moshe Rabbeinu, he knew, right, that if they're going to the land of Israel, he's going to be the next leader. He would rather not be the leader, not go to Israel, keep Moshe as the leader. I want to remain the disciple. It's interesting, when one of the great Hasidic Rebbes passed away, so the dynasty fell on the shoulder of one of two men, the Kutzker Rebbe or the Chedushia Rim. And they were both great. They were both great. And they both eventually became big Rebbes with thousands of followers. Interesting, there is no Kutzk today, but Ger is a big Hasidic dynasty. I say it's interesting because the Chedushia Rim, who is from the Ger dynasty, G-E-R or G-U-R, depending on how you pronounce it, he refused to take on the leadership. He says, you know, when you're a merchant and you're in the marketplace, there's a time to buy and a time to sell. Right now, the market's open. I can buy. I can buy the truth. There's somebody like the Kutzker Rebbe. I don't want to be the leader. I want to absorb more knowledge from him and refuse the mantle of leadership. You find many of the great leaders of Israel, they never wanted to become leaders. The classic example is King David. Never wanted to be king of Israel. He didn't want, he just wanted to sit there and learn Torah, right? And it was thrust upon him, right? That was what God wanted of him. And basically, by the way, you should know, just as Derech Agav, a side point, anytime, whether it's in our community, our Rav, or any leader of Israel, Rav Shach, what it means to be a leader of Israel is it means you're shouldering the responsibilities of the people, and you have to take away from your spirituality. Where you could be working on yourself and learning more. And you got to understand, we're talking about big, big scholars. That every moment of their time is precious. They go with as little sleep as possible. They're all kulotayr, they're all Torah. Right? And they're giving that up for the sake of the community. It's interesting, we learned this from Moshe. It says when he came down from Mount Sinai in the Parsha of Yitro, you know, the Ten Commandments, it says he went straight to the people. Went straight from Mount Sinai to the people. He didn't go to his tent. You would think, you know, wow, tremendous revelations, the Ten Commandments. Go back, you know, go in your tent and go over it, you know. Meditate on it. He went right to the people, to their needs, what they need to do. Believe me, he would have liked to have gone straight to his tent. So that's what it means to be a leader of Israel. It means giving up not just your physical, not just you worry about them, you have anxieties about your fellow Jew. You know, and you have to give of your time, but you give of your, not of your physicality, you're giving of your spirituality. That's the tremendous sacrifice these people do. That's unbelievable. They're giving their Olam Haba away, in a certain sense. So Yehoshua was that devoted. He didn't want to be leader, he just wanted Moshe. Moshe's the master, Moshe's the teacher, right? And at 80 years old, I think Yeshua was 80. I think he was leader of Israel for 30 years. I think he passed away at 110. He became leader of Israel and took him into the land of Israel. Yes, we have to be very careful that we don't generalize all Hasidim into one group because we might have met one particular sect of Hasidim that say your Rebbe is not good enough. We have to be very careful about that. Okay, and each one of these situations has to be handled individually. Could be, you're right, in that particular situation. But of course, we can't generalize. One thing we can learn from most Hasidim is that we should have this devotion. We just ignore our rabbis, basically. We say, oh, okay, you have your opinion, I have my opinion. And at least when their rabbi says something, you know, he says jump, they say how high. And that's something we really need to absorb. Okay? Whether, you know, this thing you're talking about, we have to talk about later. But that's certainly a big lesson. We should have Yoshua, you know, the Hasidim would have been very proud of him. he really cleaved to his Rebbe. Okay? Alright, so anyways, Yoshua gets a bracha. One of the reasons we said is because he was such a humble person, he wanted Moshe to remain the leader, right? But he has to remain strong and fight against these spies. It's interesting, Kalev didn't get a bracha, but when they go into Israel, plural, Lashon Rabim, is used, and they're traveling. It always uses, right, because there's more than one person, right? One more, you know, 12 tribes, plural. One place where they're traveling, Hebron, it uses a singular tense, because only one spy went there, and that was Kalev, because who was buried there? Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Kalev went to pray at the gravesite of his forefathers, because he felt he needed to be strengthened. So these two people that brought back truthful reports on the land of Israel both needed, like, outside help. Yoshua got a special bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu, right? A bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu is quite powerful. And Kalev went and prostrated himself down at the Kivrei Avos, at the grave of the fathers, of the patriarchs. Okay? So they say the difference between these two is interesting. Yoshua was the type of... There's two ways you can fight evil, so to speak. What was Yoshua's method, and what was Kalev's? Yoshua's method was the following. You hear something that's heresy, right? Right? The Apikorsis against Moshe Rabbeinu, against Torah, against Hashem. You speak out. Slam them right off the bat. My kind of guy. Right? You can't listen to that. It's a Chilul Hashem. It's a Pinchas type of attitude, right? Right? Now, there's a downside to that as well as a very good side. The good side is they don't have any hashpah on you. Those type of people don't have any influence on you. The minute the words start entering your ears, you hear it, you slam them. You stop them right on the spot. Because we're all influenced by what we hear, by the way. Okay, so you don't have a chance of being influenced by them, and you correct it right then and there. The danger is, if you're dealing with other people who are very strong in their opinion, you can be killed. You can be killed. And there was a danger here, a very big danger. Yeshua could be killed. Because these people, you know, righteous indignation, you know, a religious war, these type of things, it gets very, very carried away. Okay? So that's that side. So Yeshua needed a bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? To stay strong, to be protected from the council of the spies. You know, interesting, when this is all said and done, and Yoshua does take us into Israel, he's the one that composes the prayer after the Battle of Jericho, the prayer called, anybody know? Aleinu. Which is an unbelievable prayer of tremendous Jewish pride. We thank you, Hashem, for not making us like the Goyim and all the families of the earth, who bow down to Hevel Varik. They bow down to vanity and emptiness. But we get to bow down to you, Hashem. It's a beautiful prayer. Right? That's Yoshua. Kalev was a different matter of fighting evil. Kalev had a different way of fighting evil. Kalev pretended to go along with the people. Never said a word. They were saying this, they were saying that. He was quiet. The whole time he was quiet. What happened? When they came back, all of a sudden, Kalev spoke up. He says, is this all Ben Amram has done for us? Is this all the son of Amram, referring to Moshe, has done for us? When everybody got quiet, he goes, oh good, he's going to say something derogatory. Because he's with us. He's with us. And he blasted them. He waited for the perfect opportune time, right? Throughout the Ace of Spades. Trump. Boom. Right? Blasted them. Right? You know what? He also brought us the Torah from heaven. He took us out of Egypt. He split the sea. Anything he says goes. Come, we can conquer Israel. What's going on here? We thought you were with us. Right? So, the upside and the downside of Kalev. Let's talk about that. The upside of Kalev, of course, is at the opportune time, you gain everybody's confidence, and then when you're in front of all Israel, you can blow them out of the water. right? The danger is that you could be influenced. Because continuously, for the 40 days they were traveling in the desert, land of Israel, he was listening to them spout off their false ideals. And he could have been convinced. These were great people. Great people. And as we're going to see, God willing, they had some very sound, logical arguments that all of us in this room would have fell prey to and might in the future. Hang on. Okay? So that's the danger. So Kalev went to the Kivrei Avos, the gravesite of Avram Yitzchak Yaakov, especially Avram, if you think about it, because Avram was the man one against the world. Everybody was preaching about idol worshiping, and Avram was saying no. That's why he's called the Ivri. Avram's called the Ivri, which means a Hebrew, but also means from the other side. Everybody was on one side, and he was on the other. Right? So that strength to be one against the odds, right, Kalev needed. So these are two sides of finding Evi, and I guess they're both needed, but they both need a different type of protection. Okay, let's go right into it. Let's discuss, I've given you enough hints, that their sin, again, was very sophisticated. Okay, it was a sin for them, let's make it clear. It was definitely a sin, and we're paying for it. We're paying for it big time, because you know what day this was? It was Tisha B'Av. This was Tisha B'Av. As a matter of fact, there's a very strong connection. You know, the 3 weeks, the 17th of Tammuz, the Tisha B'Av, we call Ben HaMitzrayim. It's the 3 weeks that we have certain restraints, right? We don't have weddings. We mitigate our happiness to a certain degree, right? These are three very critical weeks. Why? Because on the 17th of Tammuz, the siege of Jerusalem started. And on Tisha B'Av, the culmination of that siege, the destruction of the temple happened. Both the first, both the second. The seeds are here. The 17th of Tammuz, right, was the day of the golden calf. The golden calf and this sin are tied together. See Rashi. He'll tell you that there was like a decree upon us and we were like on probation. And we violated probation with the sin of the spies and then we got the full punishment for the sin of the calf. And the spies. Sin of the calf again, 17th of Tammuz. The sin of the spies, Tisha B'Av. Okay? And that sets the day in motion. We came back, the spies did, with a false report. All of Israel cried that night. Oh no, what are we going to do? Hashem said, you have a night of crying. A crying for nothing? You're crying for no reason. I'm going to give you something to cry about. You're going to go and wander in the desert for 40 years. First exile, so to speak, right? And it's going to be a day of perennial exile. The destruction of the first temple, exile. The destruction of the second temple, exile. Spanish Inquisition happened on Tisha B'Av, right? Both temples on Tisha B'Av. The seeds of the Holocaust was on Tisha B'Av. And so forth and so on throughout Jewish history, you can look at almost every calamity that happened to us was on this day of Tisha B'Av. As a matter of fact, when Yaakov wrestles the angel, right? You know what we talk about, 365, you know, positive mitzvahs and 248 negative mitzvahs parallel to the days of the year and the parts of the body. You know that, right? We talked about that. So it says that the angel hit Yaakov in that sciatic nerve area, right? In the thigh area. Right? So we have a mitzvah. We're not allowed to eat from there. On a cow, that nerve, that vein is taken out. Or some people don't eat the whole hindquarter because it's very hard to take out the vein, right? You know what? So that's parallel to a day in the year, right? That's a negative mitzvah you're not allowed to do. So what one of the 365, what day in the year is that parallel to? Because you know that angel that Yaakov wrestled was the Satan. He was the evil force in the world. Yaakov defeated him. But in one area, representing one day of the year, that evil force was victorious over Yaakov, which is us. And that was the sciatic nerve. That day, says the Zohar, is corresponding to Tisha B'Av. So one day of the year that, you know, that all these calamities have happened to us. Hang on. So that's it. So this is a terrible tragedy. This is a terrible sin. And we're paying for it to this day, right? No mistake about it. But in a moment, I'll explain to you why these great tzaddikim fell into the sin, what their thought process was. Okay, one more reason why Moshe gave Yeshua a blessing, and then we'll go into the whole thing of the spies and what their intentions were. Moshe Rabbeinu had to give Yeshua a special blessing. This is very important to remember. It also connects to last week's parsha. We said that Miriam, you know, was so great, and her Lashon Hara was so hard to pinpoint, right? You know, we went into that whole thing, and yet she slammed so hard. So we said maybe it was because she made the mistake of saying, you know, if Hashem speaks to us, we're prophets, Aaron's a prophet, I'm a prophet, we don't separate from our spouses. Moshe, you know, you're a prophet, why are you separating from yours? And Hashem came down and says, listen, make it very clear. When I speak to you, it's like in riddles. It's in a vision, in a dream, or any other prophet. Lo ken avdi Moshe, not so my servant Moshe, but kol beisi nemanu. He's the most faithful in my house. Pe el peled adaber bo. Lo, I speak to him mouth to mouth. One of the seventh of the 13 principles of faith, we said, was that there was never going to be a prophet like Moshe. Okay? So that had to be, we said maybe that had to be set straight. The mistake Miriam was making is equating Moshe to any other prophet. Not so. He's the father of all prophets. As a matter of fact, it says all other prophecies come off of Moshe. He's like the main source power of all prophecies. Okay? So here too, Yeshua is a direct reflection on Moshe. As a matter of fact, Yeshua is compared to the moon. And Moshe is compared to the sun. You know, the reflection, right? The reflection, if you look at Pirkei Avos, Ethics of Our Fathers, right? It talks about the very beginning, the chain link to Mount Sinai. Moshe got the Torah from Sinai, and he gave it over to Yeshua. He's the next chain link. Anything that Yeshua does, right? Any lack of faith or anything, right, if he doesn't say so, it's a direct reflection on Moshe Emes, Utaraso Emes, that Moshe is truth, and the Torah is truth, and that Moshe got the Torah from Mount Sinai. Do you understand how severe this is? If Yeshua would make any mistake and give in, it would be a direct contradiction that Moshe gave him the Torah, that Moshe received the Torah. A whole tearing down of the Masorah, of our chain link, our tradition of Mount Sinai. Right? So that was very important. He had to have a special bracha, right, that he wouldn't stray one iota from the teachings of his Rebbe Moshe, which represents our basic, one of our basic 13 principles of faith. Okay? So, because a denial of that would have been a denial in the faith of a prophet, a denial in the Torah itself, which was received through him. Okay, very important. Now, the spies. Great people, great tzaddikim, how could they do it? Number one, you have to realize that our life in the desert was a life of continuous miracles. Right? We had, you know, the well, Miriam's well, which some people say had the property of the man. It could taste like anything you wanted. Right? Dr. Pepper, for example. Lone Star Beer. Long necks. You remember? Okay. At any rate, margaritas. Okay, all right. But we have the clouds of protection that surrounded us like a sukkah, right? And you know, none of our enemies could even see us. And it killed snakes and scorpions, and even cleansed our clothes. You know, unbelievable miracles. And the man, which, right, really tastes like everything, right? It gave you spiritual insights into the Torah, right? And this is how we live for 40 years. No waste, you know, no need. To use a bathroom. Unbelievable miracles. Complete divine protection. Literally encompassed all around us. That's the way we live. A tremendous cleaving to God. We saw open miracles. Besides the revelation of Mount Sinai and the splitting of the sea and wars that we're going to see, that were open miracles. Open miracles. The sun stood still at one point. Unbelievable. You know, boy, you felt close to God. Open miracles all around you. The spies had a tremendous love for Hashem. They had a tremendous cleaving to Hashem, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They didn't want to lose it. They understood what it meant to go into the land of Israel. To go into the land of Israel meant to live b'derech hateva, by way of nature. No more man, no more clouds of glory, no more well. You're going to plant in the ground, eat food, and at the same time, without the aid of miracles, of open miracles, you have to realize that amotzi lechem min haaretz is just as great a miracle as amotzi lechem min hashamayim. That food from the ground is just as big a miracle as food from the heaven. No open miracles, no closeness to Hashem, right? And still, it's going to be demanded of you, of the children of Israel, to remain on that level of faith and trust in God without the aid of these open miracles. We can do it. We can handle it. No problem. But you know something? The generation after us won't be able to. For their sake, and for future generations, we'll bring back a false report. Because they will not be able to stand up to it. They were right. They were 100% right. Future generations did not stand up to that test. But the truth is, it was none of their business. That's not what God asked them to do. Don't try to be, you know, such a chacham. Right? So that was part of the insights. Now let me tell you something else in reference to this, which is a theme that we have harped upon in this class. There's a Gemara in Yerushalmi that talks about the different orders of the Talmud. The Talmud consists of about 60 tractates. They're divided into six orders. That's what it's called, Siddurim, six orders, right? One of the sections, orders, is called Zeroim, which means literally means seeds. And as you can imagine, most of the tractates of the Talmud, right, in that order, deal with agricultural type of things and mitzvahs involved. You know, not to sow two types of seed in the same field, right? The different mitzvahs involved, not to plow an ox and a shorty, an ox and a donkey together, all the different types of things involved here. Okay. Interesting. The Gemara says, Emuna zeh seder zeraim. You know what faith is? Faith, that's the order. These set of tractates called seeds, Zeroim. That's faith. Says the Chiddush Arim. Why? It's faith, Shemamim b'chai olamim v'zareya, that you believe in God and you still plant. Why? It says, L'chara adarava, you would think just the opposite. You would think just the opposite. Why? Says, because you've got to realize the following. Even though you yourself are doing the action, you're digging up the ground, you're planting the seed, you know, you're doing all this work, and the fruit, the vegetable, the wheat, whatever it is, come out, you have to, afal pikan, despite all your individual effort, you have to remember it's all coming from Hashem. It's a tremendous miracle. It's the same miracle as bread coming down from heaven. Manna came. Right? The only difference is that it happens in a natural way, the way God set up the system. So you could forget. You could say, this is nature. Right? It's not God. It's nature. Therefore, this is called a test of faith. When you see miraculous food coming down from heaven, oh, that's not faith. That's proof. Right? But plant and work the ground. Right? Switch on a switch and electricity lights and realize that's a miracle. The properties, neutrons, protons, all these things, the way God set it up. That's why God set it up. It's even a bigger miracle. It's even a bigger miracle because we can access the miracle. Okay? In fact, they say it's a tremendous miracle in general because even wicked people can do it. Usually an open miracle is reserved for great people. Right? If someone has an adulterous union, well, someone, chas v'shalom, right? A child will be born, which is one of the greatest miracles, right? L'chor, you would think, why should that happen? This person's wicked, he's doing a wicked deed, and yet the miracle still happens. Something to think about. So anyways, this Seder of these tractates are called Amuna, because anytime you work with a nature, you have to realize that God created nature in this way, and it's more miraculous than open miracles because everything has its unique its unique properties, he goes on to explain. Every flower, the pollinization, birds, clouds, skies, everything, every raindrop comes from an individual, like, line from heaven. No two drops come from the same source. Unbelievable. And he says, and that's why they sent the spies, Miragling. Why? They sent the spies to scope out the land of Israel by way of nature. Why, other wars that we fought, and we had some big wars with giants, Sihon, Og, we didn't send spies. We went there, it was a miraculous victory. But here, Israel, we're going to live in a derech hateva, a way of nature type of life. Therefore, we sent spies by way of nature, like people do when they're doing an ordinary war, a physical war, right? So we sent spies, great spies, right, to enforce this faith in our generation, that when we come to the land of Israel, and even though we're doing what looks like just everyday physical things by way of nature, realize that's a miracle. That's why these spies, these Miraglim, had to be tremendous tzaddikim, they say, and the heads of the children of Israel. They were the heads of the people, right? And that's why they're called Miraglim, from the word regal, the bottom part of the body, right? They're with the very lowest element of physicality, they're trying to show that too is part of God. Walking the land of Israel, conquering it, all these things by way of teva, by way of nature, that's a miracle. What seems to you as a very low level, the part of the body, the leg, the regal, is really, as it says, they were Rosh B'nai Israel. They were the head of Israel. That's really the top level of serving God. Why? Again, because anytime you evolve in the physical and you raise it to holiness, right, that's a higher level, right? I'll explain that in a second. It says that Hashem has plenty of angels on high to serve him, right? He didn't want us to remain in the desert eating man. That's no service to God. He wants to go in the land of Israel, work the physical land, say brachas, right? All the mitzvahs involved with food. And raise it to spirituality. Raise the physical to spirituality. That's why in our parsha, after the sin of the spies, we have the mitzvah of challah. Tarimu truma, raise up. That's what truma means. Raise up the physicality and spirituality. The mitzvah of challah is given to you. You're not going to have man. True, you're not going to have the clouds of glory. You're not going to have the well. You're going to go into the land of Israel, work the physical land, and raise it. Take a portion of the challah that you worked so hard on the ground to get, right? And say a baracha. Realize that's for me. Raise the physical. I want you, that's your job, not to sit there and eat spiritual food like angels all day, the man. Right? Raise, make the earth into a spiritual place, a mishkan. Okay? So that was what they're supposed to do, and the spies, out of their tremendous love for Hashem and this nearness, this closeness they felt with these open miracles, didn't want to give that up. Didn't want to give it up, number one, for themselves, and felt that future generations would fall from this level, and would not realize that working the ground, being an agricultural nation, which we were, they would lose sight that it comes from God. They wouldn't see the miracle in it. Better we stay in the desert, close to God, and recognize that God's watching over us, than to go in the land of Israel and work with a tzava, an army, an agriculture, and think it's the army of Israel that gives us our power and strength. They weren't too off, by the way. You have to understand, if a person's gonna live in Israel and make it into a secular country, that's why at the beginning of 1948, if Israel's gonna be set up secular, not recognize God's providence over it, not learning Torah, but we want to be like all the other nations, don't go. Don't establish the land of Israel. They were very close to being right. Now, after the fact, by the way, just to conclude this, that Israel is established, we try to imbue as much holiness in it as possible. But to establish it, the preset rules as a secular nation, better not to have it. That's the king's backyard, right? You go there with no faith and think everything is by koichi the oitzin yadi. That's an exact quote. My power and my strength has gotten me this. then you cause a churban, you cause the destruction of the temple, you cause an exile. They were very close. They were very, very close. In fact, they were 100% right. They only made one mistake. That's not what God commanded. That wasn't your job. It's none of your business. But logically, 100%. So much so that you know what's going to happen at the end of days? Listen to the Chiddush Yerim. He says, you know, these people are great tzaddikim. And a lot of people, when they came back with their report, all of Israel, which was on a high level, we started crying. We believed them. And we have to learn from this, that always there's going to be Nevi'ei Sheker. Minhagim ki yiravam. There's going to be false prophets in every generation. And there's going to be leaders like Yeravam. He was a bad king, right? And with their logic and rationale, they're going to seem 100% right. And our job is not to listen to them and just listen to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us and our leaders, whoever our legitimate leaders are at the time, right? And don't listen to them one iota, no matter how rational, how logical, how righteous they seem. The Efshar, listen to this. Ye'od nisyonis ke'elu kodem ha'geula. It's possible we'll have more tests like this right before the redemption. Right before the ultimate redemption is going to be called the birth pangs of the Messiah. And there's going to be a tremendous test of faith. And it says even the greatest will fall to the wayside. There will be such tragedies going on in the world that even somebody like a Moshe Rabbeinu will ask, why did you do evil to these people? Remember in Shmais? Why have you not saved them? And since I've come in your name, it's only gotten worse. In fact, they say a similar incident will happen like Mount Carmel. What am I talking about? Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu the prophet, will say to the Israel, how long will you be straddling the fence, believing in the Baal, the idol worship, and believing in God? Pick one! Here, you people that believe in Baal, build an altar. I'll build an altar to God. We'll pray. Whoever the fire comes down and takes up the offering will know that's the true deity. True, you know, right? And what happened? It was a tremendous time, right? An unbelievable miracle happened, and the fire came down. It was an unbelievable miracle. Usually you're not allowed to offer sacrifice in such a fashion outside of Jerusalem. This was an exception. And a fire came down and swallowed up Eliyahu's offering. Water and everything went up, right? And all the people yelled out, Hashem, Hu Elokim! Hashem, Hu Elokim! Everybody recognized God. Say, at the end of days, the same thing's going to happen. Except this time, it's going to look like they're right. The fire's going to come down and eat up their sacrifice. That's going to be the ultimate test of faith. Everything's going to point that they're right, we're wrong, and if you still hang tight through that, then you'll merit the redemption. That's what they say. It's unbelievable. It really would take a lot longer to tour the land of Israel. Rashi brings that down. It's a very observant point. But he cut down the time to only 40 days because God, of course, knew the future that they would get a punishment a year for every day. They would have to wander in the desert and die out because they would not merit to enter the land of Israel. Only the next generation would. So God, in his mercy, caused a miracle that they were able to do the whole thing in 40 days. And by the way, in general, we find in the portion a mistake that we make all the time. God created unbelievable miracles, and the people of Israel use those very source of miracles to complain against God. What am I talking about? It says wherever they went, there was funerals going on. And those funerals going on. God caused a lot of people to die that day, so everybody would be involved in funerals, and the spies could do what they wanted without anybody bothering them. They could go through the land of Israel, no one would notice them. So when did they come back? They came back with a report. It's a land that eats up its inhabitants. Everybody's dying there. You know, the truth is, we do the same thing. We complain to God by the very things that only years later do we see was really a blessing for us. You know, it's really, and I'm telling you, even things like, you know, those classic things, you want to be wealthy, right? Usually, people are wealthy, God knows who to give the wealth to. I mean, taking other factors outside, we're not going to enter all the factors in here, but just this factor, certain people, it's best for them not to be wealthy because they have a personality that they worry, and they get distracted, and they get more and more involved in money. And it says in our Pirkei Avos, we haven't gotten to it yet, Marba Nechasi Marba Daga, the more belongings you have, more possessions, more money, the more worries you have. You're always worrying how to protect it, where to invest it. And a person destroys themselves. They can actually destroy themselves. So sometimes Hashem knows the personality of that individual. It's best for him not to have it. And that's the very thing we complain about. Right? Well, no, everybody can think into their own. You know? Sometimes, I know as an unbelievable story with a lady that got very sick, we should know from it. She was not religious. She was in the hospital, I think it was in California, and people started visiting her. The women of the Jewish community started visiting her, Orthodox women. And they started having an influence on her. And even though she wasn't able to have children, it was a whole thing, this carried on for years and years and years. And she said, if I had it all over again, this disease was the best thing that ever happened to me. I would have never come in contact with the true values of the world and what life is all about. I would have gone on my merry way doing these things. You know, it's an amazing story. Many stories like that. Okay, let's continue. The end of the parsha, we set out the mitzvah of tzitzis. Let's talk about that briefly for a couple minutes. This is I always wondered in the secular world, they get certain things. You know, the tzitzis is to remind you of the mitzvahs, right? And even there's a little numerical device there, tzitzis, the word tzitzis, right? Spells 4, 5, 80, 5, 90. How the heck does this work? Spells 5, 90, right? 490, 5, 80, 5, 90, and then the 8 knots, and the 5 strings, 4 corners, 8 knots. There's a whole thing here. It equals 613. I can never remember the dang thing. Okay, but it equals 13. 613. Equals 613. How's it work? 590 tzitzis, and then the 8 strings and the 5 knots. So that's 13. Oh, tzitzis, they spell with 2 yuds. So tzitzis is 600, and the 5 knots and 8 strings is 613. That's how they do it. Okay, at any rate, so it's supposed to remind you of all the mitzvahs. That's what it is. You know, and men, you know, when they take the mitzvah, when we recite Shema, we do this, you know, wrap it around the finger, and when we say the word tzitzis, we kiss it, right? All right, it's a nice thing to do. I've always wondered, in the Goyisha world, in the secular world, if that's where they got the idea of to remember something. Remember, tzitzis are to remember the mitzvahs, so they always tie a string around their finger. I'm wondering. Maybe not. I didn't see that anywhere. You could do. No. That's for sure not. That I can guarantee you. That you can quote me on. It says in the Parsha of Tzitzis, Lo Sasuru, very interesting connection, because to spy is, that's the word they use. Lo Sasuru is to spy out the land. You should spy out the land, Sasuru. So here it says, Lo Sasuru achrei levavkam achrei neichem. Do not spy after or go after your eyes, after your heart, or after your eyes. Gemara says this is the end of the Parsha, chapter 15, verse 38. Okay, don't go after your heart and your eyes. So it says the eyes are like the spies of the body. The eye sees, the heart desires, and the body do it. The body does it, right? So these two areas, the heart and the eyes, are two things that can take a person out of the world if he strays after them. What's included after the heart, don't go after your heart, are all those things that are opposite the Torah. Any kind of, philosophical discussions about the creation of the world that are not Torahic, that are, talks about, that whatever they claim, any heresy, any apikorsis, anything like this, evolution, or any of these type of classes, that's don't stray after your hearts. You know, it seems logical, rational, fossils, all these things, right? These are basically coming from atheists. Right? Don't stray after, no matter how interested they seem. This is from the Sefer HaChinuch, I'm quoting you. This is a book that talks about every mitzvah in the Torah. Okay? You shouldn't think about them even. You just don't even think about them. You're violating this commandment of straying after your heart. Okay? Because by doing that, eventually a person will start saying, I just want to learn about to know how to answer them, this and that. And next thing, one thing will lead to another, and you're just out of the system. And the other one, don't stray after your eyes. That's, don't run after the lust and the desires of this world, right? He says, as an ends in themselves. Now, I'm talking about non-kosher things, right? Whether it's forbidden relationship or forbidden food, whatever it is like that, or even those things that are permissible, but you do it as an ends in themselves, right? So, because what will happen? You'll misuse your time here on earth, which you're supposed to develop yourself spiritually, and you'll be chasing, you spend your whole life chasing after pleasures. Okay, so these two things, don't go after your heart and don't go after your eyes. Don't go after false philosophies, science, anything. And science can be a tremendous proof. Not that we need proof of the Torah. So can medicine, but it depends how these people use it, right? So don't stray after these two things, philosophical things and pleasures of the world. Okay, couple more things. Those of you have to leave, but don't worry about it. You can go, I understand. I don't know what time it is. Okay, we're running late. Okay, there's a verse here that says, by the way, you find another incident in the Torah portion where someone does a sin on purpose. Someone gathers sticks in our Torah portion and gets killed for it. It's called the Mekoshesh. So he said, you know what people are going to think? They're going to think, since we have to die out in the desert anyways, we're not entering Israel, right, after the sin of spies, that we don't have to do the mitzvahs. I'm going to gather sticks on Shabbos, get a death penalty, that's what he did, and they'll learn from me. They'll learn from me that, yes, you still have to do all the mitzvahs in the Torah. You hear this? The guy gave up his life to teach a lesson that all the mitzvahs are still incumbent upon the children of Israel in the desert. Unbelievable. Chapter 15, verse 30. Follow this for one second because this is very, very important. Chapter 15, verse 30. This happens a lot to me. Okay, jump back to 29. It says you should have one Torah, right? And it goes on about a particular sin, right? And the person does the sin, he like gets cursed. He's cut off. His soul is cut off. So Ramban, Maimonides, says on this that included in this mitzvah of not to go after idol worshiping is anybody who doesn't believe, you would think idol worshiping, right? Don't bow down to a little getchka, stick and stone, right? These type of things, you know. So there's more. You know what idol worshiping is? Anybody who doesn't believe in one mitzvah of the Torah. He believes in all the mitzvahs of the Torah except that one that says don't wear wool and linen together. Right? Or for the feminists that women can't be rabbis. You know, I like all of them except that one. Says it's not a pick and choose game. You like 612 mitzvahs and one you don't like? Blasphemous. You're in the category of an idol worshiper. It's one set. That's an interesting insight by Maimonides. Okay? We'll finish with this, guys. A person should think. Well, that's it. Thank you very much. A person should think. I'll leave you with that. Says a person should think, chapter 15, verse 17, it says, Vayab achalcham alechem aretz tarimu truma l'Hashem. When you eat of the bread of the earth, thank you. When you eat of the bread of the earth, right, you should lift it up as an offering to Hashem. So, in the name of Rav Zusha, he says the following, a person was born so that he has to have food and drink. Lema'an yalal dekach as kol inyonim agashmi l'Hashem yisparach. So he'll raise all the material physical world to Hashem. Okay, therefore, when a person's about to eat, he should think into his soul. He should think, Ilu ratza kodesh baruch hu harayacho ayala ses lichayim gam biladai ayachila. If Hashem wanted to, he could have given me life without eating. Why did God set it up that I need to eat? Right? You didn't have to set it up that way. God could have done anything. Must mean, this is the will of God that I raise the food right? I raise the food, bring it up to Kedusha by using, again, the physical properties of the earth, right? And therefore, it's incumbent upon me to eat le'echol b'kedusha b'tara, to eat with a holiness, right? And a purity, not just to satisfy my hunger pains, right? And that's what it means, tarimu truma la'Hashem, raise up an offering to Hashem. That's the whole purpose of the spies going to Israel by a natural means, to teach us this lesson that you're not going to, your ultimate purpose is not to live off man, is to eat off physical food and raise it and eat it in a holy manner. To eat spiritual food in a holy manner is no kutz. And the final thing is from Avsimcha Zissel of Kelm. And I don't know what exactly, how this connects, where he gets this, but he says it on the verse that you shouldn't stray after your heart and eyes. He says, Yudi Yeshlo Tachlis, a Jew has a purpose. What's his purpose here on earth? The Tachlis is called, from our verse in the Parsha of the Tzitzis, his mission, your mission and your purpose on earth is the following. Laman tizkru vasisem es kol mitzvoisai. That's it. That you should remember and do all my mitzvahs. That's your purpose and mission in the world. You ain't a plumber, you ain't a doctor, you ain't any of these other things. You are a person, a Jew, that's supposed to remember and do all my mitzvahs. The E.F. Shar Shneim B'yachad. You can't have two of them together. What am I talking about? Look at the verse, chapter 15, verse 38. It says, 39. Remember all my mitzvahs and do them, and right afterwards, and don't stray after your heart and after your eyes. That's what he means. You can't have them both. You can't have them both. When you forget why you're in this world and you start going after your heart and your eyes, the Torahs warn you, that's not what your mission of a Jew and the tachlis of a Jew. It's laman tiskru, right? Remember, don't become a materialistic person. Remember my mitzvahs and do them. That is your whole purpose on earth. It's there in black and white. It's repeated hundreds of times in the Torah. And we just take it for granted. Okay? But there it is, juxtaposed. Remember the mitzvahs, do them. Don't stray after your heart and eyes. Keep that in mind. That's the national anthem of a Jew. Thank you very much, and have a good Shabbos.
Yeah, the spies happened on Tisha B'Av, and Tisha B'Av is a rectification of the sin of spies. The sin of spies was that they didn't have enough Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrificing for the land of Israel, and they came back crying, and crying for no reason. Therefore, every year, we cry on Tisha B'Av for not being in Eretz Yisrael. We cry in the Golis, wherever we're at. The second note is about self-pride, about self-respect, gaining respect. Yes, a person should be humble, but listen to the account of the spies, chapter 13, verse 33. We were in our own eyes like grasshoppers. And therefore, in their eyes, the inhabitants of the land, they looked at us like grasshoppers. In other words, because we looked at ourselves on a lowly level, they too looked at us on the same lowly level. This is very important. You know, everyday life, the Jew, you know, we have to have a certain pride. A certain pride, the apologetic Jew goes around there and he's always like embarrassed about his religion, then the goy looks down upon you. Self-respect, you have self-respect, you're a proud Jew, that gains the respect of the outside world. Final note, the Haftarah also deals with the spies, but the big difference in these spies is that they had an ayin tovah, a good eye. What do I mean? You look at the account of our Torah portion, they go to Israel, everything works great. People, Hashem causes people to die left and right, so no one will hassle the spies. They're able to go the length and breadth of the land of Israel. No one bothers them. They pick fruit. They come back. And what do they come back with? Everything went great, but they come back with an evil report. And the spies in our Torah, if Yahushua, is just the opposite. From the word go, everything went wrong. As soon as they got over to Eretz Yisrael, they were discovered. They had to hide in a base zona, a house of prostitution, Rachab's house. And then, by the way, they had to go in there disguised altogether. They went like they were selling pots. And then they had to flee for the mountains for another 3 days. Right? And finally, they get back to Yahushua. And what do they bring back? Nothing but a glowing report. Everything was fantastic. Everything was great. Why did they bring back a glowing report when everything went wrong?
and are despised in it. The key, the answer, Ayin Toiva. They had a good eye. They saw the good in everything. They had bitachon, right? Good eye is synonymous with bitachon. You have bitachon, you have faith and trust in God. You have a good eye, you see the good in everything. And that is what our spies in our Torah portion lacked. And I guess the rectification for that was in our Haftorah. That's the connection with Yeshua, Pinchas, and Caleb. They went in with an Ayin Toiva, brought back a truthful report, even though, if you look at it, things didn't go that great for them. But they were level B'tochen, and that level B'tochen merited Israel to be able to finally conquer Israel.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.